From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
A federal appeals court upholds Pennsylvania's ban on undated mail ballots as the Republican Party tries to get comfortable with early and absentee voting. Plus, former crypto king Sam Bankman-Fried is sentenced to 25 years in prison. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnists Kim Strassel and Alicia Finley. Judges in Pennsylvania have been arguing about these undated mail ballots in Pennsylvania for 4 years now. The first case goes back to 2020. There was a Republican state Senate candidate who was ahead. She was winning that race until a court ordered the counting of about 300 undated mail ballots in Pennsylvania. And just to describe what this looks like in Pennsylvania, you have a mail vote. You have an envelope that it goes inside to send it back, and you're supposed to sign it. And then there's a field that says date or today's date, and you're supposed to fill it out with the date that you are filling out the ballot before you send it back in. There have been a couple cases now in federal court about these undated mail ballots and whether federal law requires them to be counted. And Kim, the latest is a ruling on Wednesday we got from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And interestingly, this panel went the opposite direction as a previous panel of the Third Circuit. And their opinion is that no, the state law that says you have to date your ballot for your ballot to count is perfectly valid and is not overridden by federal law.
Yeah, it was a very, very good decision. I'm so happy to see it. And what they were doing here, this panel, which I would note, by the way, three judges appointed by Democrats, two of them overturned a lower court judge who had claimed that essentially the date provision was optional. And that judge had cited the Federal Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act does prohibit states from denying the vote based on non-material errors or omissions on voting-related documents. But what this panel said is that that didn't really apply here. They noted the history of the Civil Rights Act, pointing out that it really was aimed at sort of literacy tests and other things that were deliberately done at the time of the Jim Crow era to keep Blacks from being able to have their ballots counted. And they would catch them up with literacy tests or misspellings of the state name, things like that. Instead, this panel looked at the state law in question, which, by the way, has been upheld by the state Supreme Court. It noticed that there's no limiting principle if you say the date doesn't count, because the law basically has all kinds of provisions related to voting documents. You have to sign it. You have to put the date on it. It has to come in if they're in mail-in ballots with secrecy envelopes. And what this panel essentially said is, if you're basically going to judge that this one thing is not necessary, then you could do it for pretty much anything. And it noted that other states have other provisions and pointed out that this all is meant to be part of a state's interest in having set vote casting rules. The key line from this opinion was the ruling cannot be reconciled with the text and historic backdrop of the statute, nor cabined to the date requirement, while leaving intact other vote casting rules that serve a valid state interest. But it was a good, good opinion.
The reason it's important in my mind is that, as Kim relates, states have all sorts of rules for validly casting a ballot. Another example in Pennsylvania is the state law says that you're supposed to fill out the mail ballot, if you have one, in the same pen or pencil. And so if the ballot comes in and half of it is in red ink and half of it is in blue ink, that ballot might be set aside and not counted. Pennsylvania also requires secrecy envelopes for these mail ballots. And so you end up with sometimes hundreds of ballots that come in without them, or with the secrecy envelope having some kind of identifying mark on it. And those ballots are also set aside. And that's regrettable. And the possibility of making that kind of error, Alicia, to my mind, is one reason that many people might prefer to go vote in person, where they're checked in and they put the ballot in the slot, or they push the button on the machine, and they know that their vote is counted. There's not some process of verifying it and checking signatures and so forth that happens after the vote leaves their hand. But as regrettable as it is that some people who are going to vote absentee inevitably every year are going to make errors, Alicia, I'm persuaded by the argument that what is worse is setting up a system where the loser inevitably is going to come to court after the fact and say, well, look over there, I only lost by 50 and there's 300 mail votes sitting there in a stack that haven't been counted. I would like the judge to come in and void some kind of piece of state law in order to count those votes. And maybe, just maybe, fingers crossed, that will be enough to get me over the finish line. To my mind, the way to build confidence in elections is to run it by the book, and the rules of the game that are in place on election day are the rules of the game for that election.
I think that's right. I mean, I recall going back to kindergarten, we had this activity where our teacher gave us a sheet of paper with very detailed directions. And if you didn't follow every single one of the directions, your sheet or your paper was thrown out. And the intent of that exercise was to teach kids that you need to follow directions to the T. You can't skip certain instructions, you need to follow directions. And bringing this or applying this to the election setting, it's important that people follow the directions and you don't make exceptions for this or that omission or this or that error, because then that leads to cries out that, well, these rules are being unfairly applied. And when judges step in and essentially just throw out the rules, then you can have people like Donald Trump try to exploit this and claim that, well, the election was rigged, the judges basically overruled the state legislature and made exceptions. And that just fuels the lack of confidence and suspicions that the elections are stolen, and partisans of both parties can do that.
But interesting that this comes as the Republican Party is trying to get comfortable again with turnout operations for early votes, absentee votes, in-person early voting. Let's listen to a new Republican National Committee official, Lara Trump, on Fox News on Monday, talking about this.
We got to play the hand that we're dealt. And that means as soon as you can go vote out there. And then you spend your time every single day from that day on until Election Day, taking people to vote. We are going to have a legal ballot harvesting operation at the RNC. It's something that has never been done before. But yes, 224 days to victory. We are going to get it done. We have no other options.
Kim, what do you make of this? And the context that I would add to this is there was a lot of reporting in 2020 that people around President Trump were making these kinds of arguments to him, that as long as these rules are in place, we have to get out the early vote, we have to get out the mail vote. And he was not persuaded in that case. And that might be one thing that contributed to his loss.
It's really good to see that Lara Trump is taking this so seriously. I think it's going to be really important for Republicans going forward. Ronna McDaniel, the former RNC head who just left, she came to understand how much distrust on conservative side of early and mail-in voting was damaging the operation in major elections. And so she had already started an initiative called Bank the Vote. And it's born out of the recognition is, look, I agree with Lara Trump. You have to work the hand you're dealt. In my perfect world, we wouldn't have voting month, okay, election month. And we would try to reinstill in people the sort of civic pride that comes with showing up to vote on election day. But the reality is that's not how many states have gone. And what the RNC and other conservative groups have been doing is fighting with almost both of their hands tied behind their back, because essentially Democrats are taking 6 to 8 weeks to get all of their people to the polls and accomplishing over that long period of time what Republicans are trying to make up in a space of 48 hours or 72 hours in the days leading immediately to an election and on election day, and also grappling with all the unknowns that come with that. Maybe there's a really important city in a very important swing state that deals with a rainstorm that day and the roads are closed, or there's a snowstorm, or people get ill, or people suddenly need to travel and they're not there on the day that they have to vote. So it's been very difficult. They are trying to catch back up. As Lara Trump said, they've been playing chess while we are playing checkers. I think the impediment here is still Donald Trump, who, even though he made a little video back when Ronna McDaniel started Bank the Vote, you know, saying nice things about it. He continues to go on television and say, oh, with mail-in votes, it's a recipe for fraud, etc. And that spreads fear among people not to take part in it.
Hang tight. We'll be right back in a moment.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. I guess I would second what Kim said before the break, which is that I like to go vote in person if I can, if I'm not absent. Part of that, as I said earlier, is the ability to know that your vote is counted without worrying about, did I make some error, like forgetting to date my ballot or something like that. Two is just the civic event of it, the civic nature of it. There are a lot of people who like to go vote in person because they take a 10-year-old before they take the 10-year-old to school and talk about what we do on this day and how great it is to live in a free American democracy. But it is true that there has been an enormous expansion in voting options over the past two decades or so. And that's part of why I find this talk of voter suppression that you are often hearing on the left so unconvincing. And I would point to a recent report by the Center for Election Innovation and Research. And what they did is they went and looked at voting laws over the course of about two decades. And here is one of their conclusions. In the 2000 general election, 40% of all voting age citizens lived in states that offered at least one option for voting before election day, such as early in-person voting or mail ballots. As of this writing, nearly 97% of all voting age citizens will live in states that will offer at least one option to vote before election day in the 2024 election. And so, Alicia, I agree with Kim that maybe there is an argument to be made that we are pushing too far in the other direction of turning this into voting months. And I would also point to another report that looks specifically at 2022. It says the percentage of voters casting ballots by mail retreated to 32% in 2022, down more than 10 points from 2020, but more than double 2016. And it is an amazing change in the election system. I think that many people probably don't realize how big of a change that is. But even in a year like 2022, about a third of voters are casting their votes from home.
Right. So in recent years, a lot of states have made changes, especially Democratic states like California, Washington, Colorado have made changes, essentially allow all mail-in voting to make it more convenient, in part because they realize some of the liberal voters, young people in particular, don't go out to vote unless it's convenient or they're extremely motivated like they were in 2008 to go out and vote for Obama. And so many states, particularly left-leaning ones, have eased ballot access by extending the duration of early voting, as well as by providing essentially no excuse absentee voting for people who are registered. And even in many cases, like in states like California, you can basically register on the day of election day and cast a ballot. Now, the problem here is that it does create more issues when they are counting ballots, because then some people, their challenges to the ballot, they may not have filled everything out right on the registration. Things have to be double checked. Some ballots get thrown out. So it does provide a lot more risk that elections could be contested. In some cases, like in California, again, I'm just harking back, they have a week for the election offices to even receive ballots from the mail. And so oftentimes you don't even know who wins for another month after election day, which doesn't really increase confidence in the elections. One other point I would make is that generally conservatives and older voters are more likely to vote in person. That's just for many of the reasons that you say. They view it more as kind of a civic duty, as a civic exercise. Whereas, again, younger voters and liberal voters are more likely to vote by mail I think there was a statistic that I saw in 2022, nearly half of voters cast ballots before Election Day, which was up from a third in 2018. And some of that is probably just the convenience, and then people do like it. And I think that has actually helped in some ways to increase voter turnout. So there are kind of trade-offs here. Do we want more people casting ballots, even if you extend the duration of the voting and use different means, like mail-in ballots? This is really a state issue, and we're seeing that play out with federalism. You know, states are laboratories of democracy, and there are pros and cons both ways.
And Kim, the point to me here is that I understand the point of absentee voting to give people an opportunity to have their voices heard if they're going to be out of town and so forth. But these kinds of problems with faulty ballots, defective ballots, late ballots, what do you do if they come in after Election Day? If you accept ballots that arrive after Election Day, if they're postmarked on time, those were small problems, I think, back in 2000 or so forth, when these kinds of ballots were a small fraction of the people who are voting. But when you start to make that the norm, then they become much bigger problems.
Yeah. And I think to round back to that decision that came out about the Pennsylvania ballots, this was something that they touched on as well, too. They noted that when you vote in person, you're subject to a lot of rules, and that you're required to follow them in the voting booth. As you go to turn your ballot in, it's looked at. And sometimes we've all gone through that experience where you go to put it, like, for instance, into the scanner. And sometimes it first is not happy because you didn't fill it out the right way or something. You've got to do it the correct way. And one of the important pieces that they had in this opinion was noting that just because you're doing a mail-in ballot doesn't mean that you can't make a mistake and therefore make your ballot defective. And a state that sets aside a defective ballot, the court ruled, is not in any way denying the right to vote. It's enforcing the rules. So I think that that puts an interesting question onto some voters, which is that you do have to be extra careful if you're doing mail-in voting, et cetera, to make sure you get it all right to ensure that your ballot is actually counted. I think it poses an interesting question to states about how to do this in the most efficient manner possible. But I think the last piece are these courts and rulings like this, because we need to have all of these rules very clear up front so that voters understand completely what the upside is of each of these different procedures that they go through, what the consequences are going to be if you don't do something correctly, and that what the rules are if you end up with these very close recounts. Because the absolute worst situation is when you end up, like we did in 2020, with the ballots counted, you're now to a recount, one side is behind, and you suddenly have courts stepping in and then reinterpreting the rules. That's what really diminishes faith in election rules.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's turn to the sentencing of Sam Bankman-Fried, the Crypto King founder of the FTX crypto exchange, who was sentenced this week to 25 years in prison. And just to give a sense of how that compares, white-collar crime, the Journal has a chart. Bernie Madoff got 150 years. The CEO of WorldCom got 25 years. Jeffrey Skilling, the president of Enron, got 14. And a name people might know from recent days, Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of Theranos, got 11 years and 3 months. Alicia, what do you make of this sentence and the conclusion now of this whole FTX drama.
So I think the judge, I mean, he had a lot of discretion as judges do on the sentencing, but I think he actually probably got it right. 25 years in part, not just for the egregiousness of the fraud. And then he pointed to the lack of remorse by Sam Bankman-Fried. He continued to insist at the trial that he really didn't intend to defraud anyone. It was just all honest mistakes. There were just some number calculations. Then when he was recalled, the issue here was he had set up this separate trading house, Alameda, that was betting using customers' cash from his crypto exchange, FTX. And he was continuously funneling money to his Alameda trading house, but also using the FTX customers' deposits on the exchange to buy real estate in the Bahamas, to donate to mostly left-leaning political groups, and essentially to expand his FTX empire and to make risky bets that he figured would pay off, right? He didn't think he would get caught was the problem. And then all of this started unraveling when you had the Binance CEO, which was another exchange, raise some questions about FTX and how it was doing its own accounting. And people started selling off and pulling out their deposits, and all of a sudden FTX couldn't redeem it. So it's essentially almost like a run on the bank. And he just built this kind of a house of cards, and all of a sudden it started collapsing. And then all of a sudden he got caught and realized that he was embezzling. And then he's like, well, you know, I didn't really do anything wrong. Well, no, sorry. The prosecutors clearly showed that you were making bets or taking other people's cash in their accounts for your own. That is a no-no in any kind of securities business. And he's just kind of pleading ignorance. So I think that, again, going back to the sentence, is it appropriate? My view is that it is.
Kim, what's your read of this? And one thing to keep in mind is that many prisoners don't serve their full sentences. They get out after two-thirds or something like that with good behavior. And my view, I guess, is that having not sat through the whole trial and watched the whole thing, I'm generally reluctant to wade into criticizing a judge's sentencing, because there are all sorts of mitigating factors. You get points for contrition and you get reverse points for aggravating factors.
Yeah, I'm loath to sort of get too involved in this. And that is certainly the case here, is what you mentioned, the mitigating factors. One thing that Judge Lewis Kaplan noted as a part of his explanation for why such a stiff sentence, one, he noted a lack of remorse. And while he did say in a statement to the court that he was sorry about what had happened, that he failed everyone, I think the judge was making reference to some of the events during the trial in which there was very much an attempt by his lawyers to suggest that this was less than it was, and that he'd been doing all this because he wanted to improve the world. So there was the lack of remorse side, but also he noted the risk of future crimes. And that probably was a comment on what came to be not, as SBF's lawyers said, honest mistakes, but the very elaborate systems that he had devised to pull this off and to disguise what he had done, even from his fellow company members. And this certainly left an impression on the judge. So I'm not going to quibble with the sentence either. And obviously, a lot of this, in terms of what he actually serves, as you say, come down to how he behaves himself in prison. But I think for the public, look, we tend to get a lot more headlines about murders and et cetera. But white collar crime is a serious issue. It can damage financially a lot of people. While we're hopeful a lot of these investors in SBF will maybe get their money back, this was certainly a major league scam.
Alicia, we'll give you the last word, but my recollection is that some of the people involved in cleaning up this FTX mess were arguing that this was kind of an old-fashioned crime, and it has this gloss on it from being a cryptocurrency exchange, FTX, very high tech. But is that consistent with your read of this, that what happened here was not really related to the fact that this was a crypto business, and so not really a reflection on cryptocurrency as an idea or a technology or maybe even a business going forward?
Right. So this was old fashioned, basically embezzlement. And the fraud element is that he continued to assure customers almost all to the day that the FTX collapsed, that their deposits were safe, that they were on the exchange, when in fact, again, he had basically funneled them out to make his own risky bets and use it to enrich himself. This isn't really related to crypto directly. The Securities Exchange Commission, Gary Gensler, is now trying to wave this around and say, see, this is what happens when you don't regulate crypto. But it's not clear that Gary Gensler needed any more powers to actually go after old-fashioned securities fraud or raise questions and investigate what was going on. In fact, they had already been investigating some other crypto exchanges, Coinbase, and cryptocurrency purveyors. So it's not really clear. When there's old-fashioned fraud going on or embezzlement, the government or DOJ can step in.
Thank you, Alicia and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.